My name is Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dan.
I'd like to thank all y'all for being here. I see a lot of people that aren't regularly here. That's a good thing. Y'all are welcome to come back. We are beginning once again to go through the entire big book one section at a time, and that'll be over the course of the next 6 months. Tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about AA history, and since I've only been sober since 1984, and a lot of this stuff went on in the early 1900s, it's all going to be secondhand information. Okay? I didn't witness any of this. I did research on the computer and listened to a lot of other history talks, and the slideshow that you've got are some of the main people I'll be talking about. I want to start talking a little bit about alcoholism and the history of alcoholism. Throughout recorded history, there have been problem drinkers. One of the first problem drinkers that's written down in history was Noah. The story in the Bible talks about there being so much sin and degradation in the world that God wanted to wipe out the population, and he decided to save Noah. Which is odd that he would save Noah and his family when you realize that Noah was an alcoholic. The reason I say that goes from his writings when he talked about getting drunk and dancing naked in front of his children. And after that 40-day and 40-night rehab cruise that God sent him on, the very first thing he did when the boat landed was get out and plant a grapevine. So part of the story is hard to tell because what we're dealing with is a universe that I like to think of as synchronistic. Okay? In a synchronistic universe, miracles can happen because certain things come into play and move around, and eventually the impossible happens. Okay? Alcoholism was also recorded about 3,000 years ago, written by, I believe, King Solomon in Proverbs in the Bible. In chapter 23, 29 through 35, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has strife, who has complaints, who has needless bruises, who has bloodshot eyes, those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine, do not gaze at the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Now, how many people can relate to this? Your eyes will see strange sights, and your mind will imagine confusing things. You will be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on the top of the rigging, with the world rocking back and forth. It didn't say that. They hit me, you will say, but I am not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? And this was written by a man who actually liked to drink and was able to drink, but he recognized that a lot of people had problems when they drank. Benjamin Rush was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and in 1790 he recognized and wrote an article, and in it he talked about people who are problem drinkers perhaps not being just bad people, that it was the result of some type of illness, that it wasn't a moral problem. Now, throughout America, the history of the culture of drinking, we all watch TV. One of the shows I've watched a lot of lately, I kind of got hooked on it, was the Gunsmoke reruns. And I don't know how many of y'all remember Gunsmoke, but these people were constantly slamming the booze. It was, let's go get a drink, let's go over to the Long Branch. It was one thing. I remember Festus, accordingly, when they had the temperance preacher that come in and was talking about, having a town with no alcohol consumption allowed. I remember Festus saying, well, hell, most of us was weaned on sour mash. We come right off the titty to it. Said, we don't know nothing else, And that's the way it was in America. There was a culture of drinking was going on, and there began to be the temperance movement, so people talking about not drinking. One of the first groups of people that got together and did something similar to what AA does was a group called the Washingtonians. Now, this group was formed in 1840 in a place called Chase Tavern. Okay, that was in Baltimore. Okay, there were six drunks in this bar, and a couple of them had just got out of jail. A couple of them had failing businesses. Some of them were unemployed because they'd already lost their jobs. They all had family problems because of their drinking. And they got to talking about it, and they actually realized that most of the problems they had revolved around their consumption of alcohol. So they said, why don't we do this? Why don't we not drink? We'll sign a temperance pledge together, and we'll help each other stay sober. So they started having meetings, and they formed a group, and they decided to call themselves the Washingtonians. Because at the time, George Washington was still a big historic figure, and they wanted to have some kind of name recognition, and they started meeting every week, and they started growing. They started growing by every week. Every week they'd meet, and the next week everybody would bring another person. And they started getting people to sign temperance pledges and join their group. Now, this group grew by vast amounts, especially when you look at the population of America at the time was about 10% of what it is now. The highest estimates show that the Washingtonians grew in just a few short years to over 600,000 members. So you figure that would be over 66 million members in today's numbers, based on percentage of population. In 1842, Abe Lincoln actually spoke at one of their meetings. And in Abe Lincoln's speech, it's noticeable that he was a very brilliant man. And when he was talking about temperance and not drinking, he was a man who could drink. And he talked in his speech about how he was able to drink. He says, but it's obvious to me that alcohol does something more for you people than it does for me. You know, that was very wise for him to see that. Washingtonians had some other problems that maybe we'll talk a little bit about later. Eventually, they just pretty much ceased to exist. But some of the people who got sober set a very good example. A lot of the people that got sober and had a spiritual program stayed sober for the rest of their lives. But what happened in America was people began to see problem drinkers turn their life around and actually become people that were worth listening to. They would get out in public and talk and tell their story. And it became understandable that drunks could get better, okay? And some of the doctors and psychiatrists started these different experiments trying to help people get sober, okay? The first person really that we're going to talk to that's on this talk about is Frank Buckman, okay? Frank Buckman recalled as a child having a vision that God told him that he was going to be a big changer of the world. And what he came to be known as someone who, not only fixed drunks, but helped other people with all kinds of vices, from gambling to womanizing to all kinds of problems. Okay, he became a Lutheran minister in 1902. He studied and visited Europe. In 1807, he was sent to Philadelphia, and he established a hostel. It was a hospice home for boys. It was kind of like today's Salvation Army, where people would come in that were destitute and not living. This was not too long before the Great Depression, but times were still good, but there were still a lot of people that were on the streets and needed help. And he started this thing, and it grew so fast. He would bring these boys and these young men in, and he would feed them, and he would give them a place to stay. And it just was extremely successful. It was so successful that the people that were funding it, after about a year, decided, this is costing way too much. You need to find a way to come up with your own money, because otherwise we're just not going to keep funding this. You know, and Frank, one of the things people talk about is he was mad because he could no longer have pancakes on Sunday morning. He said, I've got to have pancakes on Sunday morning. I got to get their bellies full to get them in church so they'll listen to the message. So what happened was Frank became resentful at the people that had ruined his financing, and he stepped away from the whole thing and he started traveling abroad. He wound up going to Keswick, England in 1908, and he was actually looking for F.B. Meyer. He was one of the real influential ministers of the day. He was actually a Baptist preacher, and he did meet with him later. I'll talk about that in a minute. But he wasn't able to meet with F.B. Meyer, and he wandered into another place, and he started listening to a lady named Jessie Penn Lewis. Okay, and this was over in Keswick, which I believe is in England. Now, Jessie Penn Lewis was a Salvation Army minister, but to tell you what kind of person she was, she's like, today we have, most of you have seen Joyce Meyer on TV. She was a female that had a message and people listened to, and she was very dynamic. And he talked to her and he shared with her about how he was depressed and resentful and not able to help anybody and be effective in his ministry anymore. And she talked to him about turning his life over to God and asking for direction, and pointed out to him that one of the reasons that he wasn't able to be effective anymore is because he was harboring this resentment. And he came to understand that his resentment was what was blocking him from God. And he made a new commitment to God and decided to sit down and write letters to the other six men that he had these resentment against. Okay, he wrote this about that period in his life. He says, I thought of those six men back in Philadelphia who I felt had wronged me. They probably had, but I'd got so mixed up in the wrong that I was the seventh wrong man. I began to see myself as God saw me, which was a very different picture than the one I had of myself. I don't know how you explain it. I can only tell you, I sat there and realized how my sin, my pride, my selfishness, and my ill will had eclipsed me from God, or as we say, blocked me from God. I was the center of my own life. That big I had to be crossed out. I saw my resentments against those men standing out like tombstones in my heart. I asked God to change me, and He told me to put things right with them. It produced in me a vibrant feeling, as though a strong current of life had suddenly been poured into me, and afterwards, a dazed sense of great spiritual shaking up. Now, he came to be known after that, as again, as a very vibrant minister that was having some effect. Just a year later, in 1909, he was asked by the head of the Democratic National Committee to go to Penn State University. Now, at this time, Penn State University was known as one of the most godless universities in the United States. It was rampant with alcoholism. The students were not even going to class. They were on strike. And the whole thing was in a turmoil. So Buckman went there, and he devised a plan whereby he could start to win these people over and get things turned around where everybody was back on a spiritual path. What he had was what's called a key man strategy. He would look around for the key people, and if he could manage to get these people on his side, then he would have a chance to get through to everybody else. He knew he couldn't preach and get all these people to hear him, but if he got certain people around the university to switch over, he'd be on his way. One of the guys was a real likable guy, and the name that I came up with in some of the writings by Buckman, he only refers to him as B, but one of the speakers I heard referred to him as Blair Buck. Okay, Blair Buck was a grad student. He was very vibrant and well-known. He was the son of a Supreme Court judge and the grandson of a governor. So he's a very well-known guy. Second guy he wanted to impact was the dean. Okay, this dean was an agnostic. Okay, he was a very influential person in that college. And the third person he targeted was a guy named William Gilliland. And everybody called him Bill Pickle. Okay, Bill Pickle had 12 children. Okay, and what he was a bootlegger. Okay, Bill Pickle was up in his 50s at the time, but he was in and out of all the sorority houses because he supplied the booze to all of them. But this guy was liked by everybody. He was the life of the party. Everybody would just love Bill Pickle. And what Buckman did, first of all, is he befriended Blair. Now, he got to talking to Blair a little bit about Christ, and I believe Blair was a Buddhist, and he got to talking to him about helping other people, and they decided that the two of them were going to target Bill Pickle. Okay. Now, just to give you some idea how Bill Pickle felt about this Buckman guy that was there sent as a preacher to try and straighten things out for the Young Men's Christian Association, He had told some people that, you know, I just assumed sticking with a knife is look at him. Okay, so he had to approach him in a careful manner. But what Buckman decided to do with Blair was they started praying for him, which is part of what we do for people that we have a resentment against. We start praying for him. Okay, so they started praying for him on a regular basis. And well, he wasn't sure where it was going to go from there, but lo and behold, him and Blair are walking along one day on the campus there, and they come around the corner and they're face to face with Bill Pickle. And he's got to do something. So he had decided when he did confront him, because, you know, Buckman had this big nose, he said what he was going to do is get as close as he could to him, so if he did swing on him, he wouldn't break his nose too bad. Okay? So what he did when he talked to him is the first thing he told him, he says, "We've been praying for you." And for some reason, when he told him that, the tension in his body went out. And he started telling him about his mother who had passed away, and how she had been instrumental in the church that was up on the hill, and how he had a nickel down in the foundation of that church that belonged to him. And he started sharing with him. He started being friends with this guy. Well, they didn't turn him around right away, but they did start being friends. They loved the horse races and this kind of stuff. They started associating and going places together. Eventually, Buckman managed to convince Bill Pickle to go with him to Canada to a young men's conference, okay? And they weren't sure how they were going to fund the trip, but when the dean of the school, which is the other guy he wanted to target, heard of this. Now remember, the dean is agnostic. He doesn't believe in all this Christian stuff, but he's inspired that they befriended this Bill Pickle, and now that he hears that they're wanting to go to Canada this retreat, well, the dean decides to fund the trip. So they take this train trip up to Canada, and Bill, you could tell he was planning on drinking on the trip, but they kept kind of working him a little bit, you know, and he just kind of laid off, and he planned on drinking when he got there, and then, you know, he found that these other people from the college were there, and there was this one guy that he knew from down there, and he wasn't drinking. He's like, you know, so he goes ahead and he decides to stay sober on this trip, but he wound up having during this trip, he wound up turning his life around and giving up drinking. And a couple of different things they talk about when Bill Pickle got back to the college. When he got back and he was getting off the train, some of the students that knew him had heard that he had had this conversion experience and had sworn off drinking. And so they actually met him at the train station with two bottles of the best. Okay, and they handed one to Bill Pickle. Okay, and as soon as he had it in his hand, he had only had it in his hand for a moment, and he intentionally dropped it on the brick and broke it. And so the next one, they took the lid off of it and was waving it under his nose, trying to get him to drink some of it. And he actually knocked it out of the guy's hand and broke it. There's also stories of for a while that some people would actually come up to Bill Pickle and just throw booze on him and stuff because they were mad that he had given up drinking and wasn't supplying the bootleg whiskey that they needed anymore. But the college began to turn around. I'm going to read a little bit of what Buckman wrote about Bill Pickle. "Now, I've been reared in circumstances where I could have liquor all my life whenever I wanted it. But there's one reason why I don't touch a drop. It's because of fellows like Bill Pickle. You don't win them if you touch a drop. Just that cocktail. I don't tell anybody else not to drink. Anybody can do anything he wants. Everybody has the liberty of the spirit. But for my part, I think of fellows like Bill. Bill Pickle, when he changed, everything just dropped off. No smoking, no drinking, although I never said anything to him about it, it is amazing how these, I won't call them sins, I'll call them nice little vices, can sometimes be the key to a man's whole life. From that time, Bill's influence in the university was a modern miracle. When the graduates came back at commencement, they didn't get tight. Bill was their favorite guest, and he refused to grace their parties if there was liquor. They preferred an interesting character, so they had their parties without liquor, and Bill was the life of the party, telling his old-time tales with new zest and on a new plane. In the university, we had 1,200 men in Bible class out of 1,600. After 3 years' work, it was no longer good form to hold drinking parties." And he talked of people coming to the college from all corners of the world to see the wonders God had wrought. So the point of this whole thing is Bill Buckman, who was the founder of the Oxford Group a couple of years later, this was his first experience with actually working with an alcoholic, and he really focused a lot in his work to help alcoholics. Okay. In 1918, Bill Buckman, who was 42 years old, met this man called Sam Shoemaker. Sam was a younger man. He was only 23 at the time. Okay, Sam he was actually in China, also with the YMCA, and he was teaching Chinese young people. And he was separated from God at the time. He wasn't happy in his spirit. He actually hated the Chinese people. He hated trying to teach Chinese people, and he was just uncomfortable and miserable. And he met with Buckman, and he had the same type of conversion experience where he recognized his resentments. He turned his life anew over to God, and he went back into those Chinese men, and he got fessed up and made amends with him. He told him, he says, "Man, I'm really not happy here." I said, I really don't like Chinese people. He said, and I've just had a miserable time. And once he did that, it turned around and really started having some success there. In 1921, after he'd spent about 3 years traveling with Buckman and going here and there, in 1921, Shoemaker was sent to the Calvary Church in New York. And the Calvary Church at that time, and this was, again, right before the Depression, had been down. There hadn't been a whole lot of success there. But Buckman, with his alliance with the Oxford Group, came into the church there in New York and started having success. They also set up what we would call a halfway house, which is a place where people could crash. And they had an ancillary building where the Oxford Group members could come and stay. And the Calvary Church had a lot of growth. In 1921, Buckman also founded the First Century Christian Movement, which is what the Oxford Group was originally called. And it continued to grow and get more famous all over the world. There's a lot of history of the Oxford Group and the kind of things that they did, you know, trying to help countries and civil wars and all this kind of stuff. They were very active trying to get people to what they later called morally rearm, to get back to God. In 1928, the South African Press actually named the Oxford Group. They started calling these people who were originally from Oxford University, this group of students that were with the First Century Christian Movement. They were wearing Oxford shirts, and they just started calling them the Oxford Group. Okay, in 1926, we get this new guy named Jim Newton comes into the picture. Now, Newton wrote a book called Uncommon Friends. Okay, it's a very interesting story. What happened was Newton went down. Let me tell you who he was first. Okay, Newton was what we call a grifter. Okay, he was a con man. And he did sales, but a lot of times what he would do is he would go into a certain place and he'd make all these sales and get all this money and then just leave and never give them the product. Okay, so, but he was a very likable, very sales-oriented guy. He was just easy to get along with, and he went down. His father bought 35 acres down in Fort Myers, okay, and they were developing this land. Now, this land was very special because it sat right dab in between Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. And that's the place people wanted to live, was between the two famous people. But he got down there and he got to know Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. Some of the writings refer to him as Thomas Edison's adopted son. They liked him that much. He would actually, one of the big things back in the day was having Thomas Edison's birthday party. And people would come from all over the world to see what he'd been working on. And this guy Jim Newton would actually be the ringmaster. He would put these parties together because he had this unique ability to get people to get along, and just he was good at networking and everybody liked him. During this time of these parties, Newton met Harvey Firestone. And Harvey Firestone also fell in love with him, but from a business perspective, he wanted him to work for him. So he hired him on as a secretary and was actually grooming him to take over the Firestone business. And during this time, in 1927, he had gone back and was living in Akron, Ohio, and this is how Akron, Ohio gets pulled into the whole Oxford Group and AA picture, okay? Because Jim Newton went back to Ohio to work for Firestone, okay? In 1927, Newton had what we call reached his bottom. Now, I'm pretty sure Newton was not a drunk, but like I told you, he was a grifter. And he'd gotten himself in some scrapes, and he wasn't happy with how he was living. And he went to New York. There was a prize fight that he went to see. And while he was there, he met Buckman. And he started hearing about this spiritual way of life and turning your life around and helping other people. And it kind of caught his attention, and he kind of tuned into it. And Buckman sent him to see Shoemaker there in New York at Calvary. And then he went back to Akron, and he was mixing with the Firestone family. Now, the Firestone family had this son, one of the owner of Harvey Firestone's son's name was Russell Firestone, and everybody called Russell Bud, okay? And Bud was a badass drunk. Okay, he was always getting in trouble. He was always in the newspaper. All this stuff of people writing about celebrities when they get in trouble, that's not new. That's been going on for eons. And Russell was a good friend of Newton. And he actually started getting involved. He decided he wanted to help him get sober. So he went with him he was constantly going on these dry out joints to try and get his life back together. He went with him to Hudson, New York for 30 days to a dry out joint. And he was dry for 30 days, but he was ready to drink as soon as he got out of there. And the best deal that Newton could cut with him on the train was that he would hold the bottle. So he was drunk again right away, and he decided to stay on the train and went all the way out to Denver to the Episcopal Conference, because that's where the Oxford groupers and Sam Shoemaker were at. And he introduced Bud to Sam, and part of what I've heard is he was actually converted on the train. And it actually worked. I mean, Bud turned his life around. He's another really likable guy, vibrant personality, and it just became really headline news again that he had been cured or fixed. They called it fixing drunks back in the day, that he had been fixed. And so they started sending people to the Oxford Group, became very popular. Okay, now we're going to start getting in some of the stuff that's in the big book. In 1931, Roland Hazard, who was 50 years old at the time, and several years before had been a Rhode Island senator for only 2 years, Roland Hazard was from big money, multimillionaire family. Okay, some in Albany, New York, his family just about owns everything. Actually, that's Thatcher. But anyway, Roland Hazard has his choice. He's a really bad drunk, and he's tried everything, and they decide they're going to find the best doctor in the world to help him. Okay, and they targeted Sigmund Freud, but he wasn't taking on any new patients. The next choice, number two in the world, was Adler. And they had to settle for the third man, Carl Jung. Now, at the time, Carl Jung was 56 years old. And remember, Roland Hazard is 50. And he winds up going, Hazard goes to Switzerland, and he actually spends a whole year with Jung. Jung had this great big ranch, so it was like inpatient therapy for a year. And at the end of the year, not only is Roland doing very well, he and Jung became very good friends, okay? I mean, they became bonded, and Jung really, from everything that I saw, really cared about Roland Hazard. And he got ready to leave and go back to America, and of course he had to take a train to get over, to get on a boat and go across the ocean. But before he even got to the boat, he wound up getting drunk again. Somebody asked him the wrong question. They asked him if he'd like a drink, and he said, sure, you know, one can't hurt. Two, well, that didn't hurt me, and two will be better. So before long, just a few short days, he woke up in a gutter, I believe in France, and he had been beaten up, and he just suffered another tremendous bender. And he went back to the doctor, you know, and he said, look, can't you fix me again? You know, and the doctor said, no, I'm sorry. He says, I misdiagnosed you. I thought you were manic depressive, but obviously you're not. You're obviously what I refer to as an alcoholic. They're a chronic alcoholic, and I'm afraid there's absolutely nothing to do but hire somebody to keep you away from booze or get locked away. That's only hope you have. Okay, and so he was depressed, you know. And this is a guy that's got all the money in the world. He can do anything he wants in the world, and now he's got this death sentence. He says, "Doc, isn't there any hope for me?" You know, he says, "Well, every once in a while, people get aligned with a spiritual movement, and they have a complete psychic change, and they get to the point where they can actually function again and not drink and be happy." So Roland Hazard winds up back in America, and he wound up getting hooked up with the Oxford Group in New York and in Vermont. Now, his family owned property in Vermont, and there's a lot of Vermont in the AA history. It's in a resort area where people go mostly on holiday. You know, they don't do much there in the wintertime, right, Fred? But in 1933, Firestone was active in the Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio. Also in 1933, Roland is at that time is active in the Oxford Group. 1933, Bill Wilson, who was one of the founders of AA, he has his first rehab treatment at Towns Hospital. Okay, now Bill's story about his alcoholism goes through many different facets, and much of that we're going to talk about and come in the next couple of weeks. But he had a lot of broken promises to his wife and tried to stop drinking several times. Okay, also in 1933, Ann Smith hears Buckman. Okay, Ann Smith is the wife of Dr. Bob Smith, who is the co-founder of AA. She hears Buckman and becomes a member of the Oxford Group. Okay, and this is in Akron. In 1934, Abby Thatcher is in Vermont. Now, Abby Thatcher is another one of these chronic drunks who's a good friend of Bill Wilson's back in the day. They ran together. They did all kinds of stuff. He was actually worse than Bill Wilson. I mean, Bill Wilson always told people, if I ever get as bad as Abby, I'm going to stop. Okay? Well, Abby has been exiled. Abby's the one that's a member of the Real Rich Family in Albany, Georgia. You know, and he's got people that are just very influential. Their business is just bigger than anything, all the money in the world, but he's just an embarrassment. So they send him out to Vermont just to get him out of the picture, just get him out of the way. And they give him this place to live, and he got in trouble three times in pretty rapid succession. Most of us can recognize when you're having these problems, these bad things just start happening. Okay, one of the things that happened is he started a fire. Accidentally, of course. And he did get burned a little bit, but up in those days and those times, you know, we didn't have fire departments. I mean, it was bad when you started a fire. That was one of the first things that happened. Another thing that happened was he crashed a car into a house. He actually crashed into the lady's kitchen and was drunk off his butt. He gets out of the car. He stumbles out of the car. He says, "Ma'am, could I trouble you for a cup of coffee?" You know? And he winds up again for the second time in front of this judge. And this judge, he just isn't having it, okay? Third time, you're going away for at least a year to the penitentiary. Is all he could do is lock people away. Well, Ebby's decided that he's going to stay sober this time for sure. So he goes back to the house, and he starts getting busy trying to figure out what he's going to do. But he actually noticed that there were a few cases of beer down in the cellar. You know, and he got to thinking, he says, you know, I'm not going to be drinking anymore, but I'm probably going to be having guests over, and it probably won't do for me to try to explain to them that I'm not drinking anymore, but I got this beer down here. So what I need to do, first thing I need to do is I need to get rid of this beer. Okay, and what's the best way to get rid of the beer? He started drinking it again. But he had decided he was going to do a few things to be useful around the house, and he decided to start painting the house. Well, he really, whether he was drinking or not, if he was drinking, he couldn't get up on the ladder because he was too drunk. And if he wasn't drinking, he was too shaky to get up on the ladder because he'd fall off. Never mind. But he painted around the house a pretty good ways, and he started drinking. You know, he just decided, you know, I've done such a good job so far, I'm going to sit back and admire my work. So he gets him a chair, and he's sitting out the yard, and lo and behold, these pigeons start flying around the house. And he's pissed. He's just painted, and these pigeons are messing up his paint. So he gets a gun, he starts shooting at the pigeons. Well, he's right in the middle of a resort community, and they frown upon people shooting firearms off in the middle of the day or any time right there around where all these people in these houses are. So back in front of the judge he goes again, and this time he's going to put him away. Well, Roland Hazard happens to be in the area, and Roland happens to be hanging out with these Oxford groupers, and one of the Oxford groupers was actually the son of the judge that was going to put him away. And actually, these Oxford group members already knew Ebby. They'd already known Ebby. They had already been trying to get Ebby to join them, and he just wasn't willing. Well, suddenly he's screwed up against the wall because he's going to send him away for a year, you know. And the judge really didn't have any choice. And they went into the judge, and Roland told the judge, says, you know, judge, you know me, and you know my family. He says, and you know how I drank, and I haven't had a drink in months. He says, and I believe we can help Ebby. He said, will you turn him over to us? He says, we'll take care of him, and we'll get him off the booze. And the judge, he just really wasn't having it. He was going to send him away anyway. And then they said the magic words, we'll take him to New York and get him out of Vermont. And he said, okay, you got a deal. Take him out of here. So they took him back to New York, and they started working with Ebby. And Ebby got better. You know, the light came on in Ebby's eyes. He was doing good. He was dry. He was a completely different person. Okay, now like I said, Ebby had been a longtime friend of Bill Wilson. And what happened was is they had got Ebby, you know, through his process of recovery, and they told Ebby, said, now, Ebby, you got to go out and share what you found. You got to find somebody else and share them to them. You know, and these guys were looking, and they said, you know, Ebby didn't want to help him. They said, well, you can always go back to Vermont and go, okay, I'll try and find somebody to help. And he thought of his old buddy Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson, this was in 1934, Bill Wilson was back in town in Towns Hospital with Silkworth. And about that time, he had just told Lois Wilson that Bill Wilson was going to die of his alcoholism, that he was absolutely hopeless, that he was going to wind up with a wet brain, or he was going to die with delirium tremens. And Bill was in the Towns Hospital three or four times. And through his course of his recovery, he had started hearing from Dr. Silkworth about the allergy of the body and about the obsession of the mind. And when he had first heard about that, he talks about in the book how he got sober for a period of time on his knowledge. You know, he got sober, I believe, on his willpower, and that failed. Then he got sober on the knowledge that he had accumulated, and then that failed. And then after he got this death sentence, you know, he got sober out of fear for a while, and then that failed. And about that time, through his really bottom days, Ebby shows up and starts witnessing to him. And he says, oh, the poor guy's got, you know, he says, what's up with you? He says, well, I got religion. He says, well, here he is. He's a crackpot on religion now, you know. But he actually started to hear, you know, he could identify with Ebby because he knew what kind of drunk Ebby was. And he knew that there was this spiritual cure. He started to hear about this spiritual cure and this Oxford group. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to learn how to do it. So what he decided to do was he was going to go down to the Calvary Mission and down there where all these guys were at. And he was going to just look around a little bit and see what he could learn about it and then just go back home and fix himself. You know, but he made the mistake on his way down there that first of all, he needed to find somebody to go with him. And of course, all his friends hang out in taverns. So he stopped at a bar and started drinking. Found this guy, and him and this other guy, after they were loaded off their butts, went on down to the Calvary Mission. And at first, they weren't even going to get in because the bouncer at the door was about to bop them. They weren't going to let these drunks in. Ebby happened to be there and happened to get them on in. And Bill Wilson, Ebby actually made a mistake when they got there and they were sitting in their chairs. If you got somebody in the meeting and they're drunk, you want to put them on the inside, not on the outside of the row. Okay, but he actually let Bill sit on the outside, and before he could stop him, Bill was up to the front and he was sharing, you know, telling him about himself and how desperate he was, and he wound up giving his life to God right there, and they were singing all kinds of Jesus songs and everything by the end of it. And Bill woke up the next morning and he says, oh my God, what did I do? He says, I've embarrassed myself. I'll never be able to show my face to everybody. He says, I was thumping tambourines and singing for Jesus. He says, and now what am I going to do? And of course, he's got to go through DTs again. He winds up back in the hospital once again. And in Towns Hospital, Dr. Silkworth had been working with drunks for many, many years. And in some of his writing, he talks about helping some 40,000 drunks and less than 1% of them ever actually getting sober for any period of time, that they just always keep coming back. But he's explained to Bill about the obsession of the mind, you know, and he know Bill is in the hospital once again, and he knows of the spiritual solution. And they give him this cocktail. One of the things that they tried a lot of different things for drunks. On this particular time, they had given him this cocktail that contained a lot of hallucinogens. And what really happened is Bill was tripping. Okay, and while he was tripping in his room, you know, he said, you know, God, if there be a God, show yourself. Something like that. And you know, Ebby had kind of broken the barriers down with him, really mostly out of frustration. He had finally told him, Bill, just any God that you pick, anything you can consider for God. You don't have to have any specific idea. It's not about religion. It's about just being open to some kind of God. And so Bill has this, what came to be known as a white flash experience, or they called it something else, the drunks did. But Bill wound up asking the doctor, he says, am I crazy or what? I mean, I saw this bright light. He says, God's in the room. He says, I feel totally different. And the doctor told him, he says, whatever it is, hang on to it. Well, Bill had already learned that he needed to share it with other people. So he started trying to share this message with other people in the hospital. And actually, from what I was, what I've learned, during that next 3 months, he stayed mostly in the hospital. You know, kind of like inpatient, outpatient. He was going back and forth to Calvary Mission, trying to work with people, trying to learn from the people in the Oxford group. And he's not having any success working with drunks anywhere in the hospital. I mean, he's going out preaching to people on street corners after he gets out of the hospital. You know, he spent like almost 6 months trying to help somebody, and nobody else is getting sober. And he tells his wife, he says, it's just a failure. He says, it just isn't working. Nobody's staying sober. And his wife Lois told him, he says, but Bill, said, it is working. He says, you haven't had a drink. You haven't had a drink in 6 months. Says, it's working just fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. Well, about this time, he has a trip planned over to Akron on a business venture. And he talks to the doctor once again. And Dr. Silkworth tried to tell him, says, Bill, stop preaching to these people about God. These drunks don't want to hear about God right off the bat. He says, start telling them about what I told you about the problem that we have. You know, you have the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. I said, after you win them over and you win their confidence, then start talking to them about the spiritual cure. So, back at this same time, Dr. Bob had been involved in the Oxford group since his wife had met Buckman and started taking him to the Oxford group. Now, Dr. Bob is also a very interesting figure, and there's not a whole lot about him in the big book. I was, you know, surprised to learn that Dr. Bob and his wife, Ann Smith, they dated for 17 years before they got married. Okay, that's typical drunk behavior, you know. They had met when they'd very young, and they'd had this relationship for all these years, and they didn't get married for 17 years. And actually, Dr. Bob had some lengthy sobriety time. In order for him to actually graduate, they required that he not drink the last 6 months that he was in school. And after he got out and then he got married, it's also said that he was sober for the first couple of 3 years of his marriage. So, you know, Bob had had some time of continuous sobriety, but then once he started drinking again, he had got to the point where he couldn't stop at all. And during 1935, during one of these Oxford group meetings, Dr. Bob actually confessed to the group. They had Truth Night, where you talk about, you know, you give up something that could be harmful to you. And he told him, he says, you know, guys, he says, I'm probably going to lose my practice over this. He says, but I'm a closet drinker, you know. And then he didn't surprise nobody. He was drunk at every freaking meeting that he came to, you know. So what happened is the group started praying for manna from heaven. They started praying for somebody to come to help Dr. Bob. And in 1935, Bill took his trip to Akron, and the business deal that he was working on fell apart. And he was just real close to drinking. He was looking at the bar. He could hear the glasses tinkling. He could hear the laughter inside. And you know, I'll just go in, and I'll have a ginger ale, and I'll meet a few people, and I'll feel better. He said, but he knew what had always worked was working with another drunk. So he started looking for somebody to help. Now, There's different variations on the story of how he came to call Tunks and get this list of phone numbers, but Tunks was very active in the Oxford group, and he had probably heard the name Tunk from Sam Shoemaker, who had spent a lot of time with Sam Shoemaker. He'd probably heard the name, and when he saw it on the marquee in the Mayflower Hotel, he decided to go ahead and call, and he got a list of phone numbers, and he started going through these phone numbers. Well, there was one number on the list that he didn't want to call, and that was Henrietta Cyberling. Okay, and Cyberling was a name that he recognized. It was actually a multimillionaire that he had helped make a lot of money in the business world. And he was afraid of contacting this family and having it known that he was a drunk, which he'd already lost everything because he was a drunk. But anyway, he decided the last name that he finally called was Henrietta. He almost didn't call her. Well, it turns out that Henrietta Cyberling, who was a busybody, was also actually Ann Smith's sponsor in the Oxford group. And she had been the one that had been leading the charge to pray for Dr. Bob. And so when Bill Wilson called her and got her on the phone, and she said, "Hey, I'm a rum hound from New York, and I need an alcoholic that I can help." She said, "Why, of course you are. I've been waiting for your call." And Bill's like, "What?" So she calls Ann Smith and she says, "You need to get Dr. Bob over here right away to meet with this guy from New York. He's got the cure for alcoholism." So when she talks to Ann Smith, says Ann, what Ann tells her, says, "Listen, it's the day before Mother's Day, and you know, he knows I love potted plants, and Dr. Bob had bought me a potted plant." He says, "But right now he's more potted than the plant, and he's laying under the table." So they had to wait till the next day. Okay. Now Dr. Bob's son tells the story of how he drove him to this appointment. And he talks about how he had told him over and over. He says, "Listen, I'm sick. I ain't going to spend no time with this preacher and crackpot. I'm tired of being preached to." He says, "I'm going to go in there. I'm gonna, just for your mother, I'm going to give her 10 or 15 minutes. If 15 minutes, come and get me out of there. Just make up something. Tell him there was a train wreck and I need to do an emergency analectomy," because he was a butt doctor. So he agrees to meet with Bob. With Bill Wilson, and he walks in, and one of the first things he told him, he says, "Mr. Wilson," he says, "I have no idea what you think you can do for me." He says, "They've tried everything, and nothing helps me." You know, and Bill Wilson looked at him, he said, "Look," he said, "you misunderstand." He says, "I'm not here to help you." He said, "I'm here because I want to drink. And if I try to help another alcoholic, that keeps me from wanting to drink." And so he started sharing with him about himself and how he drank. He started talking to Dr. Bob about Bill. He started telling him about himself and how he drank and what he'd been through and how his life had been turned around. And, you know, when he started telling Dr. Bob about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, that was the missing piece for Dr. Bob. Because as a doctor, he'd never understood what was wrong with him. That was the one thing that had never clicked. What's wrong with me? When he heard this and it kicked in, he already had all the spiritual tools, all the knowledge from being in the Oxford group for a couple of years. You know, Dr. Bob knew a heck of a lot more about the Oxford group than Bill Wilson did. Okay, he brought more to the table than just the fact that he was in Akron. So they met at the Mayflower Hotel, and their 15-minute talk turned into 5 hours. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the Oxford Group program that was shared with Bill, that Bill and Bob had learned. They had four absolutes: honesty, purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Though recognized as impossible to attain, these were guideposts to help doctrine whether a course of action was directed by God. In Oxford terms, sin, anything that kept one from God or each or another, is a contagious bodily disease. The soul needs cleansing. We know nice, sinless sinners who need that surgical spiritual operation. And the four things that they set up to do was these practices: sharing their sins and temptations with another Christian came first, surrender of the past life, present and future into God's keeping and direction, which is what we refer to as a step three, restitution to all we have wronged directly or indirectly, and listening for God's guidance and carrying it out. Okay, in 1937, the New York group of drunks that were part of the Oxford group that had been working together that there were really mostly four guys, two in Akron and two in New York, that were kind of keeping the movement going and trying to work together. They resigned from the Oxford group formally. Akron and the groups that wound up starting in Cleveland didn't do so quite so quickly. They had a meeting and they were trying to find a way to keep what they were doing going. Writing a book was the way that people transmitted ideas from one person to another at a day. So they had a group conscience and they were voting on what they were going to do. And they decided to do three things. Build hospitals, which never happened. Fund missionaries to go all over the country, which funding missionaries never happened either. And they also agreed to write a big book. And as most group consciences go, they only agreed to do it by the course of like two votes separated the yeas and nays. It took them nearly 4 years to actually write the book. And although the book talks about 100 people, there were actually 100 people involved in writing the big book. But at the time the book was finished, only 8 of them were continuously sober. They funded the book out of stock. They sold stock. They started a publishing company and they sold stock. They had a guy named Hank P. that became a member. And Hank was a salesman, and Hank was the one who really spearheaded the effort to build to publish the book, to fund the book, to get people to back the book, and they sold stock to all these different people. They wound up selling stock at $25 a share, and they sold 200 shares to people. Hank wound up keeping 200 shares. Bill wound up keeping 200 shares. They didn't put any money in. They were just doing the effort. And Hank and Bill started falling apart. Hank eventually drank again as early as 1939. He drank again, and there was a lot of friction. One of the things that happened is they had Ruth Hawk was working in their office and helping them put the book together. And you know, Hank had a little fling, you know, cheating on his wife with Ruth. And then they had moved the office away from where he was at and was getting away from him. He was taking Ruth with him, and you know, they had a falling apart, and he got drunk, and they say they actually bought him out when they moved. They had already paid for this furniture, but he was wanting to pay for it again because he needed money and he was destitute, and they gave him $200 if he would surrender his shares. As they got the book together after the 4 years, they were right at the end of the book. You don't see anywhere in the book anything mentioned about the name Alcoholics Anonymous because they hadn't come up with it yet. Okay, one of the first names that they wanted to have for the book was The Way Out because they felt like that would fit, but they checked the Library of Congress and there were too many other books by that name. They were going to call it 100 Men, and right before they were done, you know, they had a woman show up and get sober, and that screwed that deal up because 100 Men and a Woman was just too long of a title, okay? And actually, by the time they got to the point they were publishing the book, they could have called it 100 Men and a Woman because that one woman committed suicide. We were having a meeting and they had this guy named Joe. Now Joe was the owner of a very big magazine in the day. He was also a millionaire, but he had drank himself to the point that he was actually institutionalized. He was a wet brain. You very rarely could get any sense out of him at all. Okay, but Joe was at this meeting one time, and the one tale I heard it said was he was over in the corner kind of rocking back and forth, how the people that are out of their mind in a hospital do, and he just kept saying, "Anonymous, alcoholic, anonymous, alcoholic, anonymous, alcoholic." And his idea was anonymous alcoholic, okay? But another story I heard was that he just had a lucid moment, that he just had the period of time during that meeting where he had a little bit of clarity of the thought. He was a marketing guy that was in the magazine business, and that was the name he came up with. They wound up turning it around as Alcoholics Anonymous, which isn't supposed to be one, supposed to be two different, anonymous and alcoholic are just two different thoughts, okay? Just a year after the book was published, they had 110 groups, started to grow pretty quickly, and 1,500 AAs. But they still weren't selling any books. They had 3,000 books in a warehouse, and they weren't selling them. You know, it just wasn't catching on. A lot of different things happened. You know, they got some exposure here and there, and they started to grow a little bit. But the thing that triggered massive growth in AA was when Jack Alexander wrote an article about Alcoholics Anonymous. Jack Alexander was what people know of as a guy that would expose frauds, you know, people that were scheming. And they actually sent him in to intermingle with AA, catch on to what they were doing, and just tell the world that they were all a bunch of phonies. But Bill made a deal with him. He says, before you write this article, he says, I want you to spend some time and go to these different groups, go to at least 10 or 12 different groups, and don't tell them who you are. You know, you can tell them you're writing something, and you just want to learn about what they're doing. He says, but actually get to know them and see what they're doing firsthand basis. And he actually wound up writing a glowing article, and after that, AA grew by leaps and bounds. And over the next 10 years or so, up until 1949, AA itself was really spreading out, and it was doing stuff all over, but New York had kind of got separated from everything. This was before the traditions were established, and New York was, you know, Bill and Bob were like running AA, any decisions that were made about AA proper, and it was really running wild throughout the country. And it had gotten to the point where the central office in New York was down to about 6 months funding. Within the next six months in 1949, they were going to be completely without money, and they were going to have to close down. Well, Bill started writing the tradition, started studying about groups like theirs that had fallen apart and ceased to exist. Like I talked earlier about the Washingtonians. They had got involved in a lot of different stuff. They had scattered their message. They were getting involved in actual temperance. They were getting involved in various religious discussions. They were getting involved in slavery. You know, they kind of fell apart. So Bill wound up writing the 12 traditions, and he wound up deciding they had the idea that they would have their first world conference in 1950. They had that meeting. It was also urgent that they do this because Bob was on the verge of dying from cancer. He actually made it to that conference, spoke for a few short moments, and 6 months later he passed away. So they had the convention, which started where people started to be more involved in AA New York, and things grew back up to where they were getting plenty of support. And of course, the book started had been selling good. So I wanted to close with a little bit of thought about how AA came to be. You know, how, where the inspiration and where the actual message came from. And Bob, in one of his speeches, credited Sam Shoemaker with being the person that brought the message to him that he learned, and he actually tried to get Shoemaker to write the 12 steps. Okay, and this is some of the things Bill said about Shoemaker. He said, it was from Sam Shoemaker that we absorbed most of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, steps that express the heart of AA's way of life. Dr. Silkworth gave us the needed knowledge of our illness, but Sam Shoemaker had given us the concrete knowledge of what we could do about it. He passed on the spiritual keys by which we were liberated. The early AAs got its ideas of self-examination, acknowledgement of defects of character, restitution for harms done, and working with others straight out of the Oxford group and directly from Sam Shoemaker. He was the leader in America of the Oxford group, and from nowhere else. It is how well I remember that first day I caught sight of Sam. It was a Sunday service in his church. I was still rather gun-shy and diffident about churches. I can still see him standing there before the lectern, and Sam's utter honesty, his tremendous forthrightness, his most terrible sincerity struck me deep. I shall never forget it. But Sam was a very humble man, and when Sam was asked, he began to hear the rumors that he was the one that he was called one of the founders of AA. He was being credited with writing the 12 steps, and he wanted to set the record straight. And he wrote this. To set the record straight, those 12 steps, I believe, came to Bill. I think he told me they came to him in about 40 minutes, and I think it's one of the great instances of direct inspiration that I know of in human history. Inspiration which doesn't only bring material straight down out of heaven, but brings rather, I think, from God, the ability to interpret human experience in such a way that you distill it down into transmittable principles. I compare it to Moses going up on the mountain and bringing down the 10 tables of the law. And then Bill said at the end of that talk, he said, who invented AA? This is Bill Wilson. Who invented AA? He said, it was God Almighty that invented AA. This is the story of how we learned to be free. God grant, and this was a prayer, God grant that AA and the program of recovery and unity and service be a story that continues into the future as long as God needs it. Thank you.